Hello and welcome to the March episode of the Investor's Guide to China. I'm Catherine Young, Investment Director at Fidelity International.
And I'm Marty Dropkin, Head of Equities Asia Pacific.
Understanding where people live within China and why and how that migration evolves is fundamental to understanding the changing demographics and potential economic impact that all this has on the Chinese economy.
It's also crucial for anyone trying to map the big shifts of the investment landscape in this massive country, and perhaps where the next success stories will emerge.
So in this episode, we're doing something slightly different. We'll be taking you across China through the lens of both an economist and a venture capitalist.
And we'll ask, what role do migrants play in the past, present, and future development of the Chinese economy? Which Chinese provinces and cities could be home to the next unicorn?
And how will new migration patterns change China's consumption habits? And what does all this mean for the all-important property market?
So I'd like to introduce Pei-Chen Liu. She's sitting with me here in Singapore. Pei-Chen is Fidelity International's Asia economist.
Hi, Marty.
And with me in Hong Kong is Jialin Sang, Managing Partner and Head of China at Fidelity International's sister company, Eight Roads, which is a global venture capital company. Jialin has over 20 years' experience in the venture capital industry and over 15 years of investment, as well as operational experience in Silicon Valley and the Asia-Pacific region. Welcome, Jialin.
Great to be here.
So, Pei-Chen, let's start with you. Some listeners will already know a lot about China's opening up story, but what role do you think migration's played in all this?
Well, I think we just got to start with the basics of economics. Labor is a very important factor of production. So the internal migration that happened in China, long dated from rural-urban migration, was a great force to unleash this capital and labor productivity in China as a factor of production. So that's one of the major driving force of this multi-decades of supercharged economic growth.
But moving isn't as easy as it sounds, right? If you go and get a job at a factory because of the hukou system. Can you explain what hukou is all about?
In terms of China's internal migration, people have the intention to move from rural to urban areas to join the workforce in especially industrial bases in China. Everyone comes with an identity. So if we think about it in an international system where you migrate from one country to another, you need to hold a passport. In China's context, everyone holds a hukou registration system, which was originally attached to where they were born. But as they move around the country, the hukou system is still attached to their own origin of birthplace rather than where they're settling down or they're working technically. So that hukou system is tying with various social benefits, including public security, health benefits, education benefits. So that has been evolving, and cities has been gradually taking more immigrants, industrial bases, taking more workers to the city, and they are relaxing hukou gradually to allow more immigrants coming from rural to the urban area.
Jialin, maybe over to you for a second, a little bit of stage setting on your side. What's the startup scene like in China right now?
You know, a lot of the migration early on was dealing with, if you think about it, the industries that drove that were mostly manufacturing, industrialization kind of mode of China. So, you know, special economic zones being set up both in, you know, Shenzhen or around the coast, around Guangzhou. You know, a lot of that was the development of kind of manufacturing. But the next wave of growth, which gets to kind of what I do, which is investing in the next generation of companies that will hopefully be employing the labor force going forward, is all about high tech, technology, development in biotech, you know, healthcare. So if you think about it, that migration is a different set of people. And that migration is also dependent upon people migrating maybe outside of China for education purposes and then hopefully attracting them back in. That said, is driven off of a little bit of a different aspect. So getting back to your question about how is innovation doing, well, again, it's very much driven off of can you get the labor? Can you find the right founders to be able to form the next company? So I think this is a very relevant topic to, in many ways, to what I do also.
That sounds like it shifted a lot. I mean, you just talked about attracting people back into China now. It was the reverse of that, perhaps, when you started in your career. Is that right? Or have things changed that much?
Well, in my industries, you know, high tech and et cetera, if you think about it, most of the early innovations, be it in consumer tech, be it in some of the areas in software development or others, You know, we're centered around places like Shenzhen. Why was that set up as a special economic zone? It was not only to attract internal talent to come with what Pei Xuan had so aptly pointed out, which is good housing, good wages, you know, good education system for the children, but also it was set up very close to Hong Kong, close to the coast, in order to attract people that may have been educated outside, international, or what we call expats, to come and facilitate both to kind of grow together in an ecosystem to grow innovation.
So Pei Xuan, I guess taking all this into consideration, the various sectors Jarlin's mentioned, are you expecting that Chinese cities will just become bigger and bigger? And then what would this mean for headline GDP growth?
Well, I think when we talk about immigration in a second phase, which is more innovation and productivity driven, it's slightly different from the initial phase of manufacturing driven immigration, because in the first phase, we just need more workers in the factories. So people just need to concentrate and keep immigrating into the factory floors that's being established in various parts of China. We have examples of Yangtze River Delta, which is a very booming trading area in China, and also in southern parts of Guangzhou, Shenzhen, which is also attracting large number of immigrants. But as we move on to a more innovation-driven growth model, I think we probably don't need that many workers to be concentrated on established factory floors, but the quality of the labor immigration becomes much more of an important factor that people consider. So from that perspective, we are not really expecting ever-expanding megacity to emerge, but rather concentration of specialized areas of innovation. For example, in Yangtze River Delta, that might emerge as a high-tech manufacturing hub, but in the southern parts of China, that might become tech and internet hub, where people with different specializations concentrate on different areas of China.
So wherever you are in the investment ecosystem, whether you're a public investor, whether you're invested in private companies, or you're an economist like Pei Xuan, one of the most important cities to visit in China has got to be Beijing. And that's where Hyomi Ji, one of Fidelity's Singapore-based portfolio managers, recently met up with Eric Zhu, a consumer analyst who's based in Shanghai. They were on a research trip to the capital city, and the two of them caught up in a busy restaurant to go over the consumption trends they've observed sweeping the country.
I'm in a very busy mall in Beijing with a lot of brands and a lot of restaurants. So I'm joined by Eric Zhu. We actually spent a few days in Beijing to meet with the companies and do a lot of channel checks underground to see how the consumers are doing. Eric, what is the consumption picture like in China right now?
We are in Beijing, it's the capital city of China, and people here, they usually work for central governments, big tech firms, and they also work for financial sectors, etc. They are typically well-educated. So on consumption side, we see a lot of international top-tier brands, and we are also seeing the rising of the prestige brands, some of them are Chinese brands. So life here is very dynamic, efficient, and very fast-paced. We certainly did not have the luxury to get the international brands in smaller cities. People there, they just enjoy a more simple daily life, and the life pace is also slower. It's completely two different types of life.
That's in line with what the companies have shared with us today, that they are seeing some different consumption pattern between the top-tier cities and lower-tier cities, and that affects this company's business strategies as well. How about the movement of people between these cities? Will that have any impact on the consumption pattern in China?
So basically, we have two ways of movements. One is from lower tier cities to high tier cities. For example, I came from a small town in Zhejiang province, and I came to Beijing for university. I spent 6 years here, and I just developed my spending habits here. So I even got my first wallet during my university years. And yeah, before that, I just did not have my own budget. I did not have my own wallet. I did change a lot here. So basically, I recognized all these kind of brands, and I gradually be educated to find what kind of product is right for me. This is typical way that young people get educated about spending by such kind of movements. But after we graduate, some of my classmates, they return to their small hometowns and they just bring such kind of spending habits back to their hometown and the impacts of people there.
How about the rivalry between the local brands and the global brands?
Top tier cities, most competitive markets in China and most dynamic one. So the fashion chain can change very fast and people are very sophisticated in knowledge. They really understand what kind of product is right for them instead of just blindly pick a brand. So here, I do see some value for money Chinese brands. They are really offering good product, good experience. They are winning market share from international brands, especially for those international brands' lack of innovation. But in lower tier cities, people there are less open-minded to new things. So many of them, they just continue to follow their historical pattern to follow the international brands in some premium markets. And probably in mass market, people are still very price sensitive. So they just directly pick the cheapest Chinese domestic brand.
I also see from the company's strategies that this rise of local brands and also the bipolarization in the consumption pattern, especially consumers seeking for value for money opportunities, really prevalent in Chinese consumers. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you, Hilmi.
Marty, when you listen to what Hilmi and Eric said, we can't ever forget that the consumption story in China is just such a large theme. And there are so many underlying trends we're seeing, whether it's local brands taking market share from global brands, whether it's sort of low-cost brands doing well versus, let's say, mid-tier brands. There's just so much to tap into.
Absolutely, Catherine. And it ties into where our own analysts and our investment research efforts have been, getting our heads around the dynamic of the Chinese consumer, understanding where the strengths are, understanding where the challenges are, is absolutely critical to pick the right stocks, isn't it? We've seen at a macro level some real weakness in the consumer, but some stocks are still doing okay. And I think trying to find that right balance, and it could be, you know, the topics that Jarlin and Pei-Chan were talking about, you know, around movement of people around the country to get our heads around, you know, where is the demand going to be strong and where will it be weak?
Pei-Chan, you know, for many, many years, we've spoken about urbanization and the pace of urbanization in China. But Eric spoke about this concept of reverse migration. So people leaving the top tier cities and returning to their hometowns. What do you make of all this? And could this trend accelerate?
Absolutely. I think, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, that Chinese cities are unlikely to face ever expansionary phases. So now that we have established tiers of cities, first tier, second tier, third tier, by different stage of development and different models of development, the migration pattern will likely change as well. So people will likely to go and look for what's best for them. For example, in higher tier cities, there might be more advanced technology and industries concentrating around the cities. But for smaller tier cities, they shouldn't be left out. There are developed models in smaller tier cities as well that's suitable for a different group of population within the economy. So the reverse migration that you've mentioned, I would like to highlight that in context of what happened in the pandemic as well, because during the pandemic, many people have a rethink of their lifestyle. The lockdowns made people think that mobility is probably not an issue anymore. We could probably work from anywhere rather than being concentrated around office buildings and factory floors. So that might be one of the driving force behind what we see as a reverse migration. In fact, it's not just happening in China, it's happening globally, where people migrate away from mega cities to suburb areas.
You know, Jarlin, I think the point Pei-Chan just made around this reverse migration, is there something different about China as compared to, say, other countries, or is China very similar? So if we think about the U.S., where, you know, Silicon Valley has effectively been the mecca of startup activity, and is there such a dynamic in China, or is it more spread out, and how does that impact the whole startup world that you look at?
Yeah, if you look at the startup world, I think, why does certain areas become popular? Why is there a Silicon Valley in the U.S.? You know, there's really three models of driving an innovation hub, if you want to call it, which then all of us venture capitalists like to hover around, right, to find good assets to invest in. One way is organically grown. It comes up organically. And usually that is driven because there's an area where there's a lot of schools. big universities pumping out really good engineers, great minds coming together. So the Silicon Valley is a good example of that. You've got some of the greatest colleges and universities around that. You've got that in Boston also. And so therefore, you have these hubs developing. And then off of that, the ecosystem builds. In China, it's very similar. If you look at Beijing, Shanghai, you know, in Beijing, you have Tsinghua, you have Beijing University. Those are your hubs, right? There's a lot of great professors, a lot of good thinking there, and that drives innovation. Shanghai is the same with Fudan, Jiao Tong. So that's one way, the organic growth of these innovation hubs. And people get attracted to that. People move there to go to school, and then you tend to stay around there. And then you develop your life and et cetera, et cetera. The second way is, you know, government-driven, top-down driven. Shenzhen is a good example of that, where the government decided early on, I'm going to set that aside as a special economic zone. You also see that in some of the other coastal cities. You also see that in Shanghai. Tianjin was another example for fintech or financial development. But that, coupled with a lot of incentives, tax incentives, et cetera, starts to develop certain companies. In the second wave, these big tech companies or these big healthcare companies will then spawn because you've moved there for this work. You start to develop, your family starts to live there, your kids grow up there. Well, when you come out from these big tech companies, you're now a little bit wealthier, and you start up your next startup, the more likely you'll stay within that same region. So you see a lot of things spawned in Hangzhou and then also in Shenzhen because of the big tech companies that are there. And so these become your natural innovation hubs. You can argue that that's organic, but in reality, that started because, you know, the government kind of set aside and said, this is an area where we want to develop that. But those areas still need the core items, you know, that are required. Good education, good areas to live in. Your kids can go to good schools there. And it's generally an easy place to travel to.
But in these hubs or areas, would you argue that sentiment is somewhat weak?
Now that certain, you know, companies are laying off people, companies are not doing as well as they used to be, they're maybe not hiring as strong. You know, you've heard about, you know, a lot of the students that are graduating without jobs these days. Well, they can't afford to live in these cities, even with the drop in real estate prices. They may not need to live there anymore because their job is now different or not needed there. So a lot of this migration recently is also driven because the labor force needs have decreased. And so therefore, it's cheaper to go back home or maybe for a year, maybe for 2 years. And so that trend is happening. Of course, if this comes back, these areas will again attract the same people. But it all depends on how long this takes and whether or not they've established themselves somewhere else.
Pei Chen, I'm wondering, we've heard a lot about certain provinces that might have weaker finances. And how does that link to government policy? I mean, if I think about local government funding vehicles where the bonds have sold off in some provinces, is the East Coast doing a lot better in others? And probably more importantly, is the government looking at that, and are there any policy changes that you're seeing which are coming as a result of some of the movement?
Marty, I'm glad that you asked this question because that's really a critical piece of migration. Because if we think about how people are moving from smaller to bigger cities, the underlying impact of that is people start to give tax to the higher tier cities, whereas their hukou system, where we mentioned much earlier, are still tied, large likely, to their birth cities, which means that there is a very imbalanced fiscal picture out there. This imbalance needs to be resolved because essentially the higher cities are a magnet in attracting tax revenues, but lower tier cities are those who are taking the burden of spending on healthcare, social security, as well as education. So I think that's a structural issue that the government's right now facing. The previous phase of the issue was partly resolved by land sales, where local government from various states could establish themselves as one of the hubs of developments. So some provinces would be able to gather or collect land sales as a revenue to offset some of the spending deficits. But now we're facing a phase of struggles where most local governments are not able to receive decent land sales revenue as part of their income anymore. So that will largely depend back on the central government. So I think the next phase of immigration policies or immigration patterns will also largely depend on these underlying fiscal reforms that we're going to experience.
Jarlin, are you in agreement?
Patience said something quite interesting, which is that this competition of local government, right, for tax dollars is actually one of the reasons why we see everybody trying to set up innovation hubs. This is particularly true, or it was a good way to look at it, is if you look at the electric vehicle world. You know, many, many companies sprouted up throughout the country in China, and now China's probably one of the most dominant manufacturers of EV technology globally. Why? Because each local government was fighting, like Pei Shen has said, for taxes, for tax revenues. They can't lean on the traditional real estate infrastructure play anymore to be able to generate those taxes. So they needed to develop or attract good companies to come to them. What you see is a development where each local government then tries to go out and attract big employers or up-and-coming employers to their city. How do you do that? Well, again, unlike the example in the U.S. where, you know, you're trying to attract Amazon's warehouse to come to your city, you might give them some tax incentives. It's way beyond that. You're talking about providing not only tax breaks, but housing for your employees, you know, free warehouses or offices, all sorts of incentives. On top of that, which is really important, is that they start to help you develop the supply chain, the things that are needed for that company to thrive. So they try to attract the whole ecosystem into there. The downside of this, of course, is the inefficiencies, right? If each local government is trying to attract and do this, you know, does this get pulled away and therefore you don't really develop what you really need, which is a mega hub? But in some ways, I think that's a fascinating development caused by this push and pull of tax resources throughout the country.
Now, we've all been mentioning it, but one of the sectors most influenced by migration is real estate. To find out more, I caught up with Fiona Shou, our Shanghai-based analyst who covers this sector. Hi, Fiona. So you're out and about in Shanghai. Where are you right now and why are you there?
Hi, Catherine. I'm now in front of the Pearl Road Old Town Renewal Project in Shanghai Huangpu District. So there are not many people on the street because this region is under construction. This region used to be occupied by a lot of the old homes with low construction quality and no property management that is built decades ago. So now they are under demolition. Actually, I am seeing that the city renewal is accelerating in Shanghai and many other higher-tier cities where the local fiscal budgets are stronger.
So this renewal that you're currently seeing in Shanghai, does it reflect what's going on in China's broader real estate sector?
Yes, the Chinese government has put the urban village renewal as one of the three big property projects since second half last year. So the urban village renewal targets at 21 mega and super cities, including Shanghai. This will be the focus of property market in 2024 and many coming years. The on-the-ground observation is that the progress is accelerating and more government funding is on the way.
Shanghai is a huge city and home to many attractive businesses. But in cities dominated by, let's say, one big corporation or industry, so take Alibaba, who's headquartered in Hangzhou as an example, what influence does this have on actual home prices in that particular city?
Home price in Hangzhou has been much more volatile than Shanghai. The success of Alibaba once created a lot of fortune for its employees and contributed to a property upcycle in Hangzhou, which was very outstanding compared to any other city in China. The upcycle also attracted some non-rigid home purchase demand, such as the investment demand. So during this latest property down cycle, home price in Hangzhou has dropped more compared to Shanghai, both due to the squeeze out of investment demand and due to the large impact from a single industry. If we are talking about other lower tier cities, for example, like Huizhou, which is an export-driven city, the home price there is much more volatile according to the export situation. So I'm saying that for a city with more balanced industry, the home price there will be more resilient and stable. But for cities that focus more on single industry or single business, the home price will be more volatile.
You know, given everything you've been talking about, what investment implications does this have on the sector? And what do investors really need to be wary of when they're looking at the impact of these various factors on property?
For investment in China property sector, I continue to recommend consolidating into developers with higher tier city positioning, where the home price are more resilient, supported by inflowing population and less concentration on single industry. China's property sector is at the inflection point. It will not double its size in the next decade like it did in the past decade. And structurally, higher tier cities will continue to outperform lower tier cities in the longer term. As investors, we need to focus more on the offer opportunities than beta opportunities, and we need to be more demanding on companies' balance sheet when making investment decisions.
Fiona, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Catherine.
You know, Catherine, what you discussed with Fiona is so topical and so relevant. I mean, we know property continues to drive a large portion of the China economy, and trying to get our heads around the evolution of that is just critical, and how that links to different regions within China.
Absolutely. And some kind of data points or resolution in terms of when we're going to see a prolonged recovery when it comes to both property sales and development, as well as obviously confidence. Jalen, you mentioned these mega hubs or the policymakers or local government officials really trying to attract talent and migration. But really, how much do you get as a company to, let's say, establish yourself in a given city? Do you get tax benefits or extra lines of credit? How does it all work?
It's not really only about the tax rebate, because for a lot of the startup companies, tax rebates are irrelevant. These are not profitable companies. In the biotech environment, you may not be profitable for many, many years, right? Even after you go public. And so for them, it's about how do I attract the great scientists, the great talent that I need in order to develop the next successful drug or the next successful med tech equipment. So it's oftentimes they'll provide tax rebates for the top professionals or the founders. The other really important thing is non-dilutive government support. For a venture capitalist, the more money I can get into the company to help it develop, to help pay for CapEx. But unfortunately, a lot of that is dilutive in the sense that it competes against my capital. But if the government can provide non-dilutive capital to the company, I welcome it as a venture capitalist. It really helps the company. What can they provide? They can provide CapEx. They can build out the building, you know, free rent. They can provide equipment, which normally a startup company, you know, it costs a lot of money to develop a lab. For these companies to, at such early stages, to develop that or to pay for that or even to rent that equipment is not cheap. So by developing an innovation hub where many, many companies can use the same equipment makes a lot of sense. That has created, so for example, in Suzhou, the biotech innovation hub, when we first, you know, were introduced there were 10 or 15 startup companies there. Well, two or three, four or five of them now are public companies. Off of that innovation, of course, then you start to develop the next wave of people. The next wave comes from these companies. They're successful now. They're serial entrepreneurs. Well, they've grown up now in, let's say, Suzhou. Their kids have grown up there. So it's natural for them to stay there and develop their next company there. And so this is how a mega hub starts to develop, where the ecosystem itself just continues to replicate itself. Now, there's many, many governments that want to do the same thing or compete against each other, these local governments. The problem with that is that not every one of these is going to work out.
Peiqian, over to you. Let's pull it all together now. If we look forward 5 or 10 years, what kinds of things do you think we'll look back on around this topic of migration and the consumer that we'll be talking about then, you know, that we'd like to think about now?
Well, that's a very visionary question. Let me have a try on that. So let's just dial back a little bit. We're talking about 5 years later, but we really should think about what happened 5 years ago when China, the policymakers, are trying to draw the blueprints of developing various cosmopolitan areas across China, not just the coastal areas. So we're really talking about Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou, and they want to pull that a little bit more inward to have a more equitable share of growth across the country. So we have Xi'an, we have Chongqing and Chengdu, which they are trying to establish as new cosmopolitan area as well. So back to the question about what happens 5 years later, I think China is now pretty much trying to get that growth more evenly spread out across the countries. So we are probably looking at these mega cities hubs establishing themselves with each of their competitive advantage. It could come from bottom up and with the facilitation from top down. So from a bottom up perspective, each cosmopolitan area needs to identify themselves with their own competitive advantage. And what policymakers could do from a top down perspective is essentially to facilitate such developments. And that will essentially tie to the big mega migration trend. These cosmopolitan hotspots will continue to act as a magnet to attract migrations across the country.
And a final question for you, Jarlin. You were in Silicon Valley. You just got back from Japan. You're heading off to Shanghai again tomorrow. This trend we're seeing with migration, with these innovation hubs growing, you know, for the future, what's your outlook?
If I look at it from the broader world of development of innovation, you know, globally, it's always attracted to one thing. And this is particularly true, I think, in China or even in the Asian countries. You know, education is a big driver of innovation. Education is a big driver of why people move. If you think about your own life, right, the most likely time you're going to move is when you head out to college or when you head out to grad school. The second likeliest time is when you, you know, go and try to find your first job. But if you're a great student, you know, you can pretty much pick where you want to go. But usually those jobs are located in certain hubs that you want to be at because all your friends have gone there. But if you actually look at the development that I think needs to come next, you know, for China, it's great that the government says I need people to move from point A to point B, but you can't force people to move. You need to attract them. And I think education and developing that, so if you look at the US or in Europe, the development of great universities throughout the country naturally attracts talent, naturally builds the next stage of development for, at least in my world, startups, innovation, et cetera. So development of great schools, not just good schools, you know, throughout the country, and that takes a lot of effort from the government, in my mind. That will help the movement and migration of the next generation of people to come.
Wow, that's profound. Jarlin, thank you for that. If we pull together what you've just described around education and we pull together what Pei Qian described around, you know, kind of the different provinces and try to look ahead, there's a lot of exciting activity to come in China. Catherine, I think we talk about real estate all the time on this podcast. It's hard to get away from it because it is such a big driver. But I think what we've heard today, it kind of expands beyond real estate into the startup world, into thinking about, you know, taxation, into thinking about education. And hopefully that starts to drive a little bit more growth as we've been seeing ahead in China.
Yeah, and also the understanding, especially from a policy perspective, that there is a long-term plan in terms of where China sees itself, where growth is going to really be driven from. And, you know, whether it's this focus on further education, you know, ensuring that all citizens have access to this education, I think, you know, you can't just look at policy response in isolation in China. It covers so much and it almost has this domino effect, as you rightly pointed out, the impact of migration, whether it's consumption, property, future areas of growth from a provincial perspective. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you to our guests, Peiqing Liu and Jarlin Sang, and to our other contributors, Hiyomi Ji, Eric Zhu, and Fiona Shou.
And thank you for listening. If you want to read more of what's been covered today, please go to your local Fidelity website or fidelityinternational.com. The producers are Rory Fong and Noah Sin, with production support from Tommy Su, Keith Chen, Kim Ju Ko, and Seb Morton Clark. The editor is Richard Edgar.
So until next time, from all of us here at Fidelity, goodbye.
Goodbye.
This podcast is for investment professionals only and should not be relied on by private investors. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is intended only for the person or entities to which it is sent. It must not be reproduced or circulated to any other party without prior permission of Fidelity. The value of investments can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. For other important legal notices, please visit your local Fidelity website.